Well, let's go ahead and get started, and as people come in, we'll welcome them, and glad that they're coming in. And thank you, gentlemen, for coming. This is Peter Hunt back over here. He's going to marry my niece, so if anybody just wants to go ahead and interrogate him or anything, we're all good on that. And he asked me to say that as he came in. Hey, he did a great job with the proposal, the whole deal, took her to England, and Hyde Park in London, skating rink, right? Well played. Just well played. Everybody's impressed. Everybody's impressed. Even my brother is impressed with us, you know. He's hard to impress. Well, it is good to be, so good to be with you. And what I will do is I'll go ahead and get started because you realize I'm in the same spot you're in, is that I don't get to hear every speaker I want to hear. And so I'm trying to piece that all together in my mind. And I got to hear two great messages just in the last 2 hours. It was fantastic. But what I want to do real quickly is give a real brief overview of the first session so that you'll be up to speed with this real quickly. And I want to make just like a little FYI, I'm going to mention, I mentioned earlier Richard Beck, right? If you look at your program, he is speaking tomorrow and the next day. And in my opinion, if you don't mind, how many of you have ever swam where every now and then you were under the water and had trouble coming back up, but you got a breath just in time? Just get ready. If you want to go deep, go to hear Richard Beck, all right? He is fantastic. But in his book, Unclean, he starts with this illustration of this psychologist that gave everybody a styrofoam cup, asked them to take the cup, spit in it, spit in again, and ultimately then he asked them to drink it. And the outcome of that with every audience is how disgusting, how awful that is, how terrible that is. And then ultimately his point was, is that just a few moments ago that saliva was in you and you were just fine with it and you were happy to have it and you actually prefer it, you know. But as soon as it's out of you, then it becomes disgusting. And the truth is, one of our great difficulties in reaching out to other people is we are too easily offended. We are too easily disgusted. And it is the truth. We are. I had a guy tell me one time, a young firefighter that I was studying the Bible with, he said, the problem with you Christians is you're too frail. That was insulting. But I was interested, so I asked him to explain, because I want to know what he meant. And I don't hear that very often. That's a word we don't hear a lot. And I said, well, what do you mean? He said, you people get too easily offended. He said, in my job, the kind of stuff I see every single day, he said, I'll tell you what, you either toughen up or you quit. And I started thinking about that, and I thought, you know, we are a little awkward. Some of you have heard Michael Medved. He's a conservative Jewish commentator that talks a lot about media and things like that. Very interesting guy. But he said another thing that I've noticed about Christians. We got to have him as a part of a workshop in Indiana when I lived up there. And he said, one of the things I've noticed about you Christians is you have trouble understanding how the world works. He said, you seem detached. He said, let me give you an example. He said, somebody does something at Disney World, and so you all think that the best plan is to go pick at Disney World. He said, you realize that the media has an invested stake in Disney World, right? So they're not going to come and find the brightest mind among you, interview them, and put them on camera. They are going to look for the lone crazy among you so that they can use that experience against you, so you actually lose more than you gain. He said, but you don't seem to understand the world all that well. And I know what part of our problem is. Part of our problem is we're trying to not be like the world. And that's a legitimate difficulty. We're trying to not be like the world. And so in our effort to not be like the world, sometimes we're spending so much time with each other that we actually lose touch with the world. We're not understanding what people are going through. So another thing, another example that a person told me is he said, you know, a lot of times he works with one of our AA meetings, he said, a lot of times when I talk to Christians, I have to really tone back the reality of my life. I have to tone back the reality of my life. He said, no, I don't have to do that in AA, but I do have to do it when I'm with Christians. I thought, well, we ought to be the people that nobody has to tone back the reality of their life. I mean, we ought to be the place where people can really be truly known. One of the things I told our kids, we've got 5 young adult children, one of the things I told our kids growing up is I said, I would rather know exactly who you are, even if I don't like it, than for you to think you have to act like you're somebody you're not in order to be loved. Because that's not real love. The thing, two things every human needs is to be fully known and fully loved. And if we're hard to talk to, we seem aloof, a little detached, don't understand the world very well, easily offended, frail, all these things that I've told you people have said to me, then it's less likely that people will be really authentic with us. And that works against us. And I know all of you, obviously, you wouldn't be in the room if you weren't interested in sharing your faith. So you've encountered this already. You know what goes on when we seem to be somewhat inauthentic. One of the interesting things that happens in our ministry at home is we have every night of the week, we've got somebody meeting in our building, working on something in the name of Christ. And one of the things that I found with a lot of these folks is they feel like that those meetings are where they really consistently connect with God. Now hear me out, because I believe in church. I love church, candidly. Once I came to Christ, I've actually loved it the whole time. When I was a welder, I went to church every time the door was open. I actually liked it, you know, before I came into ministry. And I still like it now that I am in ministry. But one of the things I've noticed is a lot of people might think that church is kind of hit or miss, whether you connect with God, but if they can get a good AA meeting, then they're pretty sure they're absolutely going to connect. You know, a good OA meeting, a good NA meeting, a good SA meeting, they think, you know, probably they'll really for sure connect with God. A church is kind of a 50-50 thing, but I bet I'll connect. I started thinking, now why is that? And I know one of the reasons is that in those meetings, it is expected that you would tell life as it is, life on life's terms. Now, our vocabulary betrays us a little bit. How many of you have heard somebody say something like this to a kid? Don't run in church. I get don't run on the side of the swimming pool. I mean, there's a danger there. You could slip and fall. But the whole don't run in church, I'm not just getting that. Somebody says, well, come on, Don. You know, there might be older people or whatever. You know, somebody, you know. Well, then say that. Don't say don't run in church. Say don't run where there might be people that could trip and fall. See, that's the real issue. But if you tell them don't run in church, you're planting seeds of a dualistic lifestyle. It's the same thing when you say, hey, you can't tell that joke in church. What's the matter with you? Clearly, we could tell it if we were at a restaurant right now, but not here in church, right? You know, all of you know that we have a tendency to struggle with being bilingual. We've got one language for church and one language for the job, or one language for our friends, one language for grandma, you know. And what do we say to people? We'll even, don't say that in church. Which clearly means what? Somewhere else it's good, but just not here. So what are we subliminally learning? Don't wear that at church. Don't run in church. Don't say that in church. Anywhere else. So the journey toward authenticity becomes very difficult, doesn't it? Just shake your head yes, no, or maybe. It will help us make progress, right? So it is challenging, isn't it, though? Right? So if somebody actually came in and said, you know, hey, to be honest with you, I love brewing my own beer. It's just incredible. You know, I've become a connoisseur of it. What? You know, and there's all these mental checklists that go up. You're not teaching Bible class. I can tell you that right now, you know. Right? Right? And then we have some good reasons. In our church, we have, I really don't know how many members now, but I promise you there's probably 100, 150 of them that are former cocaine addicts, and there's all kinds of addictions going on at our church. Everybody's addicted to something probably, but anyway, we're working on it. And so everybody that works in our ministry directly with people that are overcoming alcoholism, we've asked them to refrain from using alcohol. Because we understand there's a lot of pressure on folks for whom that one drink is just death. And we get that. All right? So I'm not taking this loosely. But it is absolute silliness to suggest that anyone who is a real Christian won't drink alcoholic beverages. That's just complete silliness. I mean, it is so Americanized evangelical Christianity that its roots are nowhere in Scripture, that anyone who's a true Christian would never do that, right? So the whole idea, though, is we've learned this dualism to where you can't actually admit that, so you got to drink on the sly. But that's crazy. That is absolutely crazy to create an atmosphere like that, because it's a barrier to reaching people. Because that's not how they're living. And so they're going to either learn one of two things. Oh, I have a glass of wine occasionally, so don't go there. Or have a glass of wine, but learn to lie to go there. You all know the foolishness of that. None of that's serious, right? We get that. It won't work. Okay? Now, if you said to someone, let me tell you my reasoning here. My reasoning here is I really don't want to influence somebody to drink. Well, God bless you. Then just say that. when my dad quit smoking. How many of you smoked or had a friend that smoked or family member smoked? Raise your hand. Go ahead. Okay. All right. So how many is 3 packs a day? That's 60 a day. So you're humming, right? My dad was a 3-pack-a-day guy. And I mean, you know, any of you that have smoked a lot or known somebody that did, so he's lighting one off the next one. You know, I mean, he's just putting it out and putting them down, you know, trying to keep the stress down and run the construction company. And for 42 years, my dad smoked. But there at the end, he had ramped up to be a major contributor to the success of Marlboro. And so and we tried everything. It's silly. You know, we tried to hide his cigarettes. My mom actually decided she would start smoking to shame him out of it. He liked it because he had someone to smoke with. So that didn't work. So she quit, you know. So in the end, my dad was visiting us, and we only had two of the boys at the time, our oldest son Don and our next son Aaron, and they're sitting on my dad's lap, and I had this conversation with my dad. I said, "Dad, you know, look, man, you know, both of my granddads had died from smoker-related disease." I said, "Dad, I really wish you'd consider it again." You know, this was in December of 1986. In 87, in February, my dad quit, unannounced, no fanfare. That's, my dad is not like that at all. And so I don't find out for a while that he's kicked the habit. So I'm like, you know, what happened? You quit smoking. He said, "Well, let me set you straight on something." He said, "I didn't quit for biblical reasons." I'm like, "Well, what about the whole temple of the Lord thing?" But those of you that have lived long enough, you know, we didn't know a whole lot back then. We didn't know enough about it all back then. But anyway, so we were learning slowly. If you go to Germany or Australia, on the sides of big cigarette cartons that they take through the airports, it says, "Cigarettes cause a slow, painful death." It's on the packaging. It's amazing. You know, cigarettes will kill you. It's on the packaging. But it wasn't on the packaging that way back then. And so anyway, my dad quit. And so I asked him, I said, "Well, okay, if you didn't quit for that reason, why did you quit?" And he said these words. He said, I don't want to be the one that teaches my grandsons to start smoking." Okay. I appreciate the honesty. I just appreciate the candidness. At that time, he wasn't convicted about it spiritually. So why act like you have a spiritual conviction for someone that something that at that time you don't? Now, what that does for the way that my dad leads people to Christ is when my dad is leading people to Christ, they feel like, well, he's kind of on the same journey we're on. It's not like he's about 16 or 17 laps down the road with a bullhorn trying to call us through the woods. He's in the woods with us. Then when he's trying to figure out motivation, well, I'm trying to figure out motivation. I'm trying to piece it together as well. So these are kind of some of the things we need to start thinking about when we're trying to reach people for Christ. If they're living life on life's terms, we need to be more honest about how we're struggling to also live life on life's terms. The great news of the gospel is a God who engages with people who are struggling along, desiring to make it. You know, the name Israel that Jacob, remember, after he wrestled with God, he was renamed Israel, that means struggler with God. So of all the names God could have picked, he could have called him Johnny, he could have called him anything, he picked struggler with God. So what's the name of God's people? Strugglers. And that's God's name for his people. Strugglers. Wouldn't it be great if the world knew strugglers for God meet here? Because they might feel like, "Oh, well, I can do that." You know? I mean, if you have a ladder up here and you need to climb the building and the rungs on the ladder are out of your reach, nice to have a ladder, it's useless. So in outreach, you got to think, well, where do the rungs on the ladder need to be? Does that make sense? So we started our ministry with people that are struggling with cocaine addiction. You know, a couple of things we learned along the way is, one, you know, some of our folks would have been clean 5 or 6 hours by the time they came to church. I'm serious, right? And then you'd have people that would make it a good long time and then relapse, you know, and then give it another shot. We learned a lot about that along the way. But one of the things we learned was that I've never met a person that had one addiction. I have yet to meet a person who had only one addiction. So what I started realizing is we might have to take this, you know, a little bit, maybe one at a time. So when we realized that a lot of people weren't coming to church because they couldn't sit through the whole service and then the Sunday school class without a cigarette. Like, because what that meant was get on the bus, come over to the van, get, you know, come over to our campus, be there, you know, our service is like 75 minutes long, you know, so we're going to sit through that. Then we're going to go through an hour long Bible class and then wait around a little bit of fellowship, then get back on the van and get back over to the place before you have a cigarette. I mean, they just thought that's impossible. I'll never make it. Well, you're thinking to yourself, well, you know, cigarettes will kill you, and you know, you have the temple of the Lord. They're not thinking about that. And any of you try to quit smoking, you are not thinking that 30 seconds to 30 seconds. So we decided to put in designated smoking areas. Well, some of the people at our church were a little unhappy with that because they felt like we were promoting something that was very unhealthy. And I told them, I said, you know, bear in mind, we're not promoting something that's unhealthy. We are recognizing unhealthy behavior that some of you in our church have. You just have your own car and you can leave campus for a few minutes and go smoke and come back. They can't. So we're just going to try to pray this. I said, the other thing is, I doubt that by doing this, that our youth, the primary message that our youth are going to get out of this is that we believe that, you know, you should smoke. I really think the primary message that our youth are getting out of this is, people are living life on life's terms, and we're trying to meet them where they are living life on life's terms. That's what we're aiming for here. Now, the other thing that's interesting is that some of the folks in our church who are sharing their faith with these people can look at somebody and say, hey, listen, we have a shared struggle. We have a shared struggle. Vincent Donovan, really interesting story. Vincent Donovan wrote a book called Christianity Rediscovered. Vincent Donovan was a Catholic priest. He grew up, and all he ever wanted to do was to become a priest missionary. That's what he wanted to do. So that was his dream. And so he went to all the training to do that. And he ends up in Africa, in Kenya. And he's going to work with this tribe. So he gets there and serves for his first year. And he writes his bishop a letter. And you can read all of this in his book, Christianity Rediscovered. He writes his bishop a letter. And basically, though, he's with the Maasai tribe. Okay? And in his letter, he writes these words to the bishop. He says, I've been here for a year. Catholic missions have been here for 100 years, since 1866, and this is 1966. And the number for our mission is zero. He says, that is a real number in his letter. That's a real number. Zero. Zero lasting adult converts. Zero. We have hospitals, we have schools, we have outreach, we have all these things, but the number is zero. So I'm quitting this. I'm not going to do this anymore. I am not going to give candy to their kids. I'm not going to ask them to send their kids to our schools. I'm not doing any of that anymore. I'm going to go out and share the gospel and let the gospel stand or fall on its own merits. So he goes out, he meets with this chief, this Legoan of this tribe, he meets with the guy, and he says to the chief, this is what he wants to do, and sounds like a good plan. So the chief says, well, explain to me, what you really want to do? And Vincent Donovan says, I want to share with you the Most High God. And the chief of the tribe says, well, what makes you think I don't already know him? Vincent Donovan, in his very humble way, says, so I went out and laid down in my tent under the canopy of the African sky, and I thought about that. He says, so the next day he went back into the tribal leader, the chief, and he said, I have a better idea. Why don't we search for him together? Because what is the truth about Vincent Donovan? He's still searching for God as well. What's truth about you and me? We're still searching for God in some ways, right? We're still searching, right? We're always searching to know him better. So it was authentic. It was true. You're searching. I'm searching. Maybe you're on a different part of the path. Maybe you some parts of the path better than I know. Let's search for him together. Here's what's interesting. When he made that break and made the decision just to live out the gospel purely, just live out the gospel, in 17 years when he finally left and they commissioned him to leave because they were ready to send out all their own missionaries and raise up all their own elders and all that stuff, 3,000 believers. What was the fundamental shift? The fundamental shift is we're going to live life on life's terms. We're going to experience walking toward God together. That will change the outreach you have in your church. We talked about this morning, the story of God means receiving God, knowing God, sharing God. Now I want you to think for a few minutes about yourself and all the people that live around you. Okay, so you've got your friends, you've got your neighbors, family, co-workers, associates. Like, for instance, like, depending on where you are, who might fit in as a neighbor, right? If you're in college, then that could be a roommate, it could be somebody down the hall or something like that. Co-workers, person in the cubicle, person that works for you, person that you work for, so on, associates and so on. So you kind of got the picture, right? All of these people that are in your life. My wife got this idea for outreach. She started hosting these dinners at her house. She loves hospitality. She grew up in a very hospitable home. This is one of her gifts. So that's what she wanted to do. So she started these dinners called Arrive as Strangers, Leave as Friends. It is wild, okay? I wasn't sure how it would all pan out, inviting people we all knew, at least we knew their names, but that they didn't know each other, right? So how is that going to work? So, first time we did it, she had this idea, and it was pretty smart. She said, let's do this. She said, let's have everybody come over for Thanksgiving. We'll just tell the family that we're going to do one of these dinners, arrive as strangers, leave as friends. We'll do it on Thanksgiving, and we'll invite a lot of people who probably don't have a place to go for Thanksgiving. Well, that was pretty smart, you know, because people want to go to Thanksgiving somewhere, and they don't have a place to go. So, it's probably a little better idea to come to our house. And so, she had this idea. That's what we're going to do, you know. And she said, well, what we'll do is we'll have it in the morning, and then we'll go down to downtown Atlanta in the evening to this project called Hosea Feed the Hungry, and we'll go down there and we'll feed the homeless and see if we can work that out. And there's a couple reasons for that. One of them is it's just good to go do that. The other thing is that when people serve together, it changes your interaction with each other. You know, it equals the playing field because, you know, you don't have to be super theological for us to go down there and try to clean up all the dishes at the end of the day from feeding 20-some thousand people, right? So that could work out. So everybody comes over to the house. Well, they sit down, and man, this rush of fear just waves over the top of me because I'm thinking, I actually know these people, and I know their issues. And I'm thinking, if he starts talking about that, she's going to be feeling really uncomfortable because I know the issues in her life, and I know that he's a loose cannon, you know? And I'm thinking, oh, man, this could really go badly. So I'm taking God out of the equation, and I'm, of course, trying to manage the situation with my own fears and my own limited skills. So we get ready to have the prayer, and this guy named Troy, he leads the prayer. Of course, he hasn't been a Christian long enough to depend on himself, so he knows just to depend on the Lord. See, hasn't been around long enough to quit depending on God, right? And so he prays up a great prayer about depending on God. So glad we're all here. Well, we start around the room, and here's what I know. The lady to my left has become my friend. She's lived a lesbian activist lifestyle for years, and she's beginning to wonder what she's going to do with her life. But she also has a huge alcohol problem, and she's on the potential of losing this terrific job because of her alcohol problem, right? Well, so I'm wondering how this is all going to unfold. So I just said to Troy, this guy to my right, I said, hey, Troy, I said, how about you do this? Introduce yourself and then just share one thing that you're really thankful for, right? Harmless, right? So heads around the room. And as it's going around the room, it's coming around to this guy that's the loose cannon doesn't touch it. I mean, hairpin trigger on the loose cannon. And it comes around to him and he says these words. He gets choked up and he said, the thing I am so thankful for is that today I've been sober 67 days. Well, I knew his loose cannon. I knew his name. I didn't know he was an alcoholic. I didn't know any of that. And I didn't know he'd been sober 67 days or 67 months. And why did that come out? And why did God give the gift of that confession to the table so that when we got around to the woman to my left that I was so scared about, she's already in tears. And she said, you want to know? I'll tell you what I'm thankful for. I'm thankful for something different than what I was going to say when he first asked the question. I'm thankful for you. Thank you for sharing that. I haven't been sober since last night. And I am sitting there thinking to myself, Don, when are you going to get it that God is the evangelist? God is the evangelist. See, we get freaked out because we are confused about his role in this thing. You'll never meet a person that he doesn't know. You'll never want a person he doesn't want. You'll never teach a person that he doesn't know what they need to hear. It will never happen. So I started thinking to myself, this could actually work out. We can start doing this more often. So my suggestion to my wife was, let's do this more. I mean, of course, I'm thinking every weekend, you know, maybe not every weekend, but she gets into it. She gets excited about it. It's making more and more. So she says, let's do it with the neighborhood. Now, the neighborhood is a little more scary because if you were in the earlier session, you know, we had kind of a tough way to go with one of our neighbors, lives two houses down. Well, Susan had this idea, we'll do it with the neighborhood. So she got this brilliant idea that we would do it in the cul-de-sac and we'd have a great big cookout in the cul-de-sac with all of our neighbors, right? Well, one of the things that she didn't and I didn't fully piece together is that there might be more alcohol than food. And there was way, way more alcohol than food. And some of them were incredibly economical. The guy that lives just to the next house of me, Jeff, he's incredibly economical because he shows up drunk. He came inebriated. So this is, you follow what I'm saying about economical. He's not going to drink much because he's already completely trashed. And so he comes in and he walks over to me, you know, And he's been weaving his way through everyone else, and you can tell he's like Moses. He's parting the Red Sea. Nobody wants any part of him. He gets over right to me, and he's like, he comes up, "Now what do you do again? Aren't you a priest?" You know? And, he's Jewish, but he's ready for me to bless him, right? And he says, he goes just like this. He looks right at me and he goes like this, "Bless me, Father, for I have sinned in front of my neighborhood." I'm reaching for a bottle of wine at the, no, I'm just kidding. I'm like, how does this happen? And my wife is over here with these two or three ladies that are really easy to talk to and they're real sweet. And I'm like, get over here, you know? So there I am with Jeff. Well, the interesting thing about that situation was Jeff, see, just like anybody, when he wakes up the next morning, he feels like an idiot. And he's all covered in shame. This is in our neighborhood. And then it's awkward, and he doesn't want to make eye contact with people, and he doesn't want to wave at the mailbox because he feels so stupid. So what do you do? Well, this is in October, and a couple of months later, you guys know it doesn't snow very often where we live, but when it does, it's a mess, you know? And I hear this knock on my door, and I go to the door, and it's Jeff. And he said, "Hey," he said, "my car is stuck down at the bottom of my driveway. Can you help me?" And I go down there, and he's got his BMW stuck up to its axles in mud. He'd backed down his driveway, and it slid in the snow and ice and off into the grass. So I started working on it, and I could tell he didn't have a clue. And I worked on it for almost 2 hours, and I finally got his car out. And "Thank you so much," he said. "Listen, man, I'm on my way to a meeting. Thanks." Man, you know, I just thought to myself, my goodness, you know, here is a moment in time that God orchestrated for us to do this. And I told him, I said, "Jeff, if you ever need to go to a meeting, I'll take you day or night. I'll go with you. We'll sit together. I'll go with you to a meeting." And that started opening doors with Jeff. So Jeff starts coming over to our house. I didn't tell you how we met him. I'm sorry, I left this piece out. The way we met this guy was he was drunk. He's out. He's out in his boxers with nothing else on. He's completely drunk. And he's calling for his dog, and I think his dog's name is the F word, because that's what he's yelling at his dog. This is a true story. True story. Just screaming at the top of his lungs. He sees my wife and my daughter, walks over to him, puts his arm around him. Holy smokes. You know, this is how we met him. "Hey, my name's Jeff." Oh my goodness. So now what's happened is over time, see, that Jeff starts coming over to these, come as strangers, leave as friends, this kind of a thing. Then when our kids start getting married, he starts coming over and risking coming over to their house, to homes of Christians. So he comes over to one of these showers hosted in a Christian's home, and he tells me before he gets there, I mean, he is nervous as he can be. He comes and he says, "Hey, listen, man, I can only be there for 5 minutes, but I'm going to come for Jerome. I'm going to be there." He comes in there and he's there for over 2.5 hours. And he just can't get over how much love there is in the room. He just can't stand it. And he finally risks coming to church. And he's just overwhelmed. He's lived in our community for 40 years. He's never been in a church, never been with our church. So the next thing I find out, that he's decided to go with a mission team to Haiti with First Presbyterian Church, because he met him through a business contact. And he's going, he said, "You know, that preacher down there is a pretty nice guy." And I'm just thinking to myself, why am I stuck on this idea that these are first and foremost my associates, co-workers, family, neighbors, and friends? You could put God right in the middle of that. Because God's in the center of all of these people, longing to redeem them. If we believe Scripture, we can't escape that. The Bible says that God longs for no one to perish, but for all to come to repentance. 2 Peter 3:8 and 9. Do you believe that? If you believe that, then it will change how you view your interaction with the people around you. It will shift it. Now, I'd like us to think a little bit together about how to get this done. One of the things we started thinking about was, I am a proponent of serving people, period. I just think that's the right thing to do. Because God is at work in every kingdom thing we do. So, you know, sometimes you don't get much more of a chance with somebody than to serve them or whatever. But I wanted to create sustainable ways in our community where we could level the playing field so that believers and unbelievers can do things together. You understand what I was aiming for there? Because what do we oftentimes have trouble with? We have trouble getting times together. If you go to church together, that's okay. But how many of you tried to get to know someone at a movie? Going to a movie is about the most unproductive date you can have. Because you're going, you stare at a screen. It's not bad. I mean, it's not like it's a bad thing, but there's not much getting to know each other in the middle of that, right? So you got to bear in mind, going to church can end up being the same way. You follow my thinking? And I was noticing that. I was noticing that we would bring people to church, but unless we could get them to go to lunch with us or come to one of these dinners at our house, it was tough to get to know them anymore. Because what are you doing? You know, you're sitting there and you're singing and watching and listening, which is all fine, but we weren't getting the kind of interaction we wanted. So we came up with this idea called Serve Day. We started it 7 years ago, 67 people. Now we have about 750 or 800 people that participate in this. And we do it on a Saturday. We get everybody to come together in the mornings. And no matter where they come from in the community, we bring them in. They get the t-shirts. They get set up on these teams. They register online, set up on these teams. And we bring everybody together. Now in this picture right here, these two guys were not members of our church when we did this. The two guys in the middle, okay? The older guy there and the guy to his right, okay? All the rest of those guys, members of our church, so they're together on this project for 5 hours. On this project. So, I mean, you guys have worked together. You've done a little bit out. So, you know, you're talking and you kind of get to know each other as you're doing that. Can you hold that? Can you swing a sledgehammer? All that kind of stuff. Anybody know how to run a chainsaw? You know how all that goes. So everybody starts getting to know each other. Well, where are you from? Where'd you learn that? So the next, and then we end the day with a big dinner celebration. So everybody comes in and they're sitting around. Of course, we smell like you can imagine. We come in, everybody eats together, has a good time. Now here's what's crazy. This guy has not missed my Bible class since last October. Has not missed my Bible class since last October. It's the craziest thing. We'll sit through a sermon. He loves country music. We'll sit through a sermon and he'll text me a song and say, "Hey man, let me give you a song that sounds just like the passage you preached from today." I'm serious, you know? And so we love this. Now, the other funny thing is we decided to partner with the city. We got this idea. I noticed that my fire hydrants, you couldn't find them. You know, my house had burned down while they tried to trim the bushes away from the fire hydrants. So I went to the mayor and I said to him, "Hey, I've got an idea." I said, "Is there anything we can do to help you clean up the fire hydrants?" I said, "The fire hydrants on my house are all grown over with brambles. You can't see them or anything." And he said, "Well, we'll talk about it. That sounds like a great idea." I didn't know there were 1,521 fire hydrants. I know that now. There are 1,521 fire hydrants. They didn't have an updated map of their own fire hydrant. So we ended up working with the city, had these four couples that went out and they mapped all the fire hydrants. And then they got the idea that we wouldn't just clean them off, we'd paint them, right? Holy smokes. That ended up taking us almost three years in different cycles painting all these fire hydrants. But why do I have this? This guy right here, member of our church. That girl right there, one of the nurses that took care of me when I was in the hospital for a month. The one I told you about earlier, right? So one of the things that started happening here was we found ways to connect. So now what happens is this guy here, member of our young adults ministry, spending time painting fire hydrants with somebody who has point blank told me, "I will not believe, but I'll give your church a chance." Okay? Well, listen, I love that candor. I love it. I would much rather someone be straight up and tell me that than to lie to my face and tell me that they really think some of them and just drift off. I much rather prefer this. But what did I understand? If she comes to church, she can look like she's listening, and you'll never know if it's going in or you have no clue. You get on a day like this and the several days that follow after that, and then we started doing these things where we'd get together with people that were trying to put up these sustainable gardens and stuff like that, and get hooked up with them and call people on the phone and tell them, "Hey, come down and do this project." And while they're together, it evens the playing field, because an atheist can work in a garden right next to a Christian. An addict can work in a garden next to someone that has overcome that addiction. Serving together changes the playing field. This couple here, this is Troy and Karen, and my wife Susan on that side. I was speaking at a corporate event for this corporation in Atlanta, and they had their annual event. They asked me to come and speak at this annual event. Well, this guy and his wife, these are professional photographers, and they were the photographers for the event. So my wife and I were walking down the hallway, and I said, "Hey, I think those are the photographers. Let's go say hi to them." So we walked up, said hi to them. "How you doing? Where are you guys going?" "Oh, we were going to go get a cup of coffee." "Well, let's go together. You mind?" "No, we'd love it. All right, I'll buy you a cup of coffee." So we go in, we sit down, start talking, figure out we're from Atlanta. They're from Atlanta. I thought, well, that's cool. And so I said, "Where do you live?" They told us, you know, not too far from us. And so I said, "Well, let's get together when we get home." Well, later on in the conversation, you know, of course, it always comes down to what do you do? And then, you know, they find out I was a minister, and then, you know, they put on the mask and, you know, all the protection and, you know. So we didn't see him for a while. In fact, we didn't see him for another year. But that corporation asked me to come back and speak the next year. I go back, guess who's there again? The photographers. I thought, yes. So we have another round. So that time we have dinner with them, and I said, listen, man, this time when we get back to Atlanta, we're going to get together. Here's what he said to me. He said, we actually do need to get together. He said, my mom's dying. I could use some help. I said, all right. As soon as we got back to Atlanta, I called him up and I said, hey, we want to come over and meet your mom. Susan and I went over there, met his mother, started making these visits to his mother. You know, sometimes people don't make very good decisions, right? And it can really plague their lives. And you start coming down toward death when people have made a series of not so good decisions, and there's lots of pain hanging out there on the table, and you know the time is shrinking to deal with it. Shake your head if you get what I'm saying. And can you imagine trying to go through that without the presence of the Lord in your life? We can. You know, the fear, is my mom going to die and we've never got this thing worked out? So there we were, night after night, just sitting there, you know, listening to stories, you know, kind of making the connections, connecting the dots. All of a sudden, our church auditorium's kind of in a horseshoe. One Sunday morning, I look off to my left, and there he is. And then I noticed, well, she's with him. So as soon as it was over, man, I ran back there and I said, what are you doing here? See, we've been sneaking in for about 6 weeks. They had been there for 6 weeks, but they didn't want me to know that they'd been there for 6 weeks. Now, a little nervous about the hook, right? So I was like, well, man, this is great. Glad. Come on, let's go out to lunch, you know. And you should always make yourself available when you go out to lunch for people that are guests. Don't hang out with your friends all the time because then you miss the guests. And so, so they come over, we go out to lunch. Well, the next thing you know, remember I told you that arrive as strangers, leave as friends deal? Okay, well, they came to the first one of those, got hooked up into that. Then they came to serve day with us, and we had them down at the City of Refuge in downtown Atlanta. They got hooked in the City of Refuge. They couldn't believe it. They were so excited. So finally, we invite them over to our house for a Bible study. We're going to share the gospel with them. So we're sitting there, and I said, I did it again. Back up. How many of you have heard of men's fraternity? Anybody? Okay, some of you. Okay, this is a guy in Little Rock. Can you remember his name right now? Robert Lewis. Okay, guy in Little Rock put together this three-year deal where it's basically the fall and the spring where men get together and they watch this video, help him growing into manhood, better husbands, so on and so forth. And then you have these discussion groups and so on. So I asked him to come with me. This is on Monday mornings at 6 for 28 weeks. Monday mornings at 6, boom, first week, bang, he's there. He never misses. So we're going through this. Well, it comes time for Christmas. We come around, and the leaders of the men's fraternity, they said, Don, we want you to present the gospel to these men. It's Christmas. Let them hear the story of Jesus Christ. I couldn't wait. So I love telling that story about Jesus. So I get up, tell the story. He leaves, and on his way to work, he texts me, is this a good time for me to tell you I'm Buddhist? I said, well, as good as any, you know. So then, of course, we invite him over for the Bible study. Okay, I left out that part. We invite him over for the Bible study. They get there, and I said, okay, how long have you been Buddhist, you know? And he said, about 15 years. I said, wow. I said, what happened like 15 years ago? He said, well, I was really struggling with an anger problem, and my wife and I had both concluded that if Jesus were on earth, he wouldn't be a Christian. Really? Well, why did you conclude that? Just terrible experiences with churches and stuff. And I said, well, my goodness. I said, you know, it's so sad that you had those negative experiences. But, you know, you want to be careful to judge all of life off of negative experiences because you might really miss the mother load of great experiences over here. I said, you know, you can have a bad mechanic and miss the three good ones. So, you know, you got to really be thinking here, you know. And I said, and especially a photographer, I said, we've seen lots of bad photography. Come and look at our first son's wedding. I mean, it's terrible photography. I showed him the picture. They're like, good grief. You know, she should be fired. Exactly. But, and they did the next two, and they were awesome, so that helped share the gospel. But anyway, so what I said was, listen, how about this? Let's just read the Bible together. And he said, well, I really want to. He brought his granddad's Bible from 1943 that was issued to him as a soldier. Okay? He said, I've had this for a long time. He said, it's called a King James. He said, will it work? I said, absolutely. Let's go for it, right? So we opened the Bible. There's no sense in telling him to read mine when he's already got his own. My minor was biblical languages. I get the whole translation thing. But you see, I'm not trying to sell him on a translation. I'm trying to live life on life's terms with where he is. If he brought his own Bible, the last thing I'm going to do is take his and give him mine. You follow where I'm coming from, right? So here we are. We start studying the Bible together. Well, they never miss. Monday nights, we're studying the Bible together. And we're rolling along, and I thought, you know, we probably ought to go ahead and figure out who Abraham is and some folks like that. And that was really good. And finally, I said to him, I said, can I ask you a question? He said, yeah. I said, you know, did Buddhism work? Yeah, it was great. So I said, and I said, hey, I'm just being real with you, okay? And I said, so why did he do it? Anger problem. I said, so it worked. I said, so why are you interested in Christianity? He looked at me like, do you not know your own story? He said, well, there's no God in Buddhism. I knew that just testing you. seriously, right? This is the kind of stuff I'm running into. Like the lady, the Muslim lady that came to Christ, and she looked at me one day in an outreach class, and she said to me, she said, Don, it's not up to you Christians to decide that we Muslims don't want to hear the gospel. Tell it to us and let us decide what we'll do with it. You know, right? So anyway, finally they came around to where they wanted to be baptized into Christ in June, and he had grown up swimming in this river up in the Tallulah Gorge up in Georgia, and that's where he wanted to be baptized, 1,142 steps down to that. A little tough to get out, and not that I was counting, but I was, and baptized him into Christ. Well, where that went was we started getting to know this girl right here, okay? That girl is Abby, and I told you a little bit about Abby earlier, Abby Jelinek. Abby grew up in a Jewish family, went to IU to go to school. Some people planted some seeds of Christ in her. She came to our church, and when she got to our church, an older couple, Bill and Jan Hooten, brought her in. We started studying the Bible with her, and my wife and my daughter-in-law taught her the gospel, shared the gospel with her, and then I started sharing the gospel with Kobe, her husband, and then this is our preaching intern and his wife. This couple, she's from Australia, he's from Romania, she's from Turkey, Russia, and the Bahamas. And so we got this group together. Yeah, it's a little crazy. Black, white, tan from all over the world, you get the thing. And so we start sharing the gospel. Well, one of the things that's crazy about it is this girl here shares the gospel like a Jewish girl that's become a Christian. She doesn't share it like a Christian girl that grew up all of her life like that. She shares it like for who she is. Okay? Sounds a lot like the New Testament. It's really interesting. Then this guy here grew up in a Romanian family that believed in Christ. But he's never read the Bible, never studied the Bible. So he is incredibly interesting. Well, through her, I meet another couple that isn't in this picture. They invite them to come to the Bible study. They get to the Bible study, and this is what happens. They're in the Bible study, and as soon as I call out the scripture reference, I see this guy just going crazy on his iPhone. And I'm watching the man and the woman, this couple. I did their wedding, by the way. Did their premarital counseling, did their wedding. That's how I got to know him. And so he's over there flipping around, and I can't figure out what he's doing. And he looks up at me, and he says, hey, man, is there an app for the Bible? He wants to know if there's an app. He's going to download the Bible on his phone. Before I can say a word, this is our adopted son here. Before I can say a word, he texts him an app for the Bible. And he looks at me. I got it. Next thing I know, they downloaded the Bible. It's a new world, people. I'm telling you. Right? I love this one. I've had this baby for 20 years. I don't want to give it up. That's not what matters to them. The form it comes in doesn't matter. What's inside it matters. And here they are sharing the gospel together, sharing the gospel with each other. And as this thing starts to unfold, then what I start realizing is all of these ideas we had about who would be interested and who wouldn't go out the window when you remember who's interested first. And that's God. Now, Troy and Karen, we after they were baptized, we studied with them every Monday night for a year, grounding them in the faith. Okay? So I said to him, I said, I want you to co-lead the Bible study with me now. You need to co-lead it. No sense in acting like you don't know enough to co-lead. You gave your life to Christ. That's enough to share what went on in, you know, because of Jesus, right? And so he's a little nervous about it. So we take a couple of months and we prepare this Bible study to teach to these people, right? So now you have a former Buddhist and a former Jewish girl who are teaching the Christian faith to people that are hungry about the gospel. Doesn't this sound like what you read in the New Testament? So why wouldn't we just go ahead and be a part of that? And see, what's confusing to many of us is, and I'm going to beg you, if you don't get anything out of this session, get this. We need to learn again how to share our faith. Let me tell you what happened to me. I got to the point, and I don't think there's anything wrong with what I'm about to say. It's wrong with what I did with it. I got to the point where I knew this well enough that I was trying to share the faith and was forgetting to share my faith. What people want to know is, why do you believe? Why do you believe? Why do you believe? Why do you believe? They don't first want to know what. Look at how big this is. The book. Look at how big that book is. It's intimidating. But you're an entry point for someone. And so you say to someone, let me tell you why I believe. Share your faith. Now, there's examples of it all through Scripture, right? Let me give you a teaser for tomorrow afternoon. So we got the blind guy in John chapter 9. You remember this comedian? You remember this guy? He is fantastic. I can't wait to meet him when we get to heaven. He's quick-witted, super sense of humor, absolutely amazing. But he has this one line he keeps sharing in John 9. Do you remember the one line he keeps sharing? All I know is I was blind, but now I see. Well, where's Jesus? What does he say? Well, that's remarkable. I was blind, but you asking me where he is. How would I know? You know, remember this? You remember this guy? And when they're just pounding on him, remember that? He said, look, I already told you once. What, do you want to become a believer? And then they just thrash him. You know, they're so mad at him, you know. And the crazy thing about it is he has just this one line. What's the one line, though? It's his faith experience. What's he sharing? I'm sharing my faith. I can't answer all your questions. I don't even know. You know, he might have even thought the same thing the disciples thought. Maybe he thought he was blind because he sinned or his parents. Maybe he hasn't figured out the Deuteronomic theology and how the story of Job fits into that. But I think what he had was this. I met Jesus and my life is different. And that's the part I absolutely know for sure. And what would be awesome is if you'd take the time to tell people what you absolutely know for sure. Sharing your faith. Well, we got to quit, so I'm going to quit with this story. Historians, September 1939, what happened? Some of you know. Yep, that's right. Blitzkrieg. And it was, what's your name again? Don? Or who said Poland? Oh, way to go. What's your name?
George.
Way to go. Way to go. This was the invasion of Poland. Absolutely right. Blitzkrieg, Germany going into Poland. Have you ever wondered why they picked that route first? One of the things that had happened earlier in the 20th century is in the Russian Revolution, the Jews were horribly mistreated then, so they immigrated by the tens of thousands to Poland. The Polish people weren't on board with this. They were struggling with the illegal immigrants coming in. They wanted quotas put on them. They did not like the fact that they were there and the economic impact. And they also put educational quotas on them because they didn't want too many of these Jewish people coming into their areas, aliens, ended up in their schools and taking their student spots. And so they started a thing called benching. Benching. You can look it up. But some of you have heard about this. And what they did is when you'd come into a classroom, you had a student body card. On yours, it said you had to be benched, meaning you had to go to the left and sit on just benches with no desks. And that's who separated the Jewish immigrants from the rest of the group. Everybody else get a desk, sit over there and so on. This going on. And so what Hitler banked on is that he would find sympathetic people in some of the countries he was invading. That's what he was banking on. You remember what this war looked like? Soldiers, tanks, air warfare, and mass graves. A lot of those mass graves left children as orphans. But three women, Sophia Kosack, Matilda Getter, and Irina Sendler, were founders of this group who decided that they would do something about the children. Irina Sendler, growing up in that early part of the nation, or early part of the 20th century, she grew up in Poland. Her dad was a doctor. In fact, her dad was an outstanding doctor. But the interesting thing, and their family was Christian. The interesting thing about her dad was he was one of the few doctors that would treat Jews and would treat people with typhus. Most of the rest of them said, forget it. We're not going to treat the Jews and we're not going to treat people with typhus. We're not going to do that. But her dad did. In 1917, her dad died of typhus. So he died living out his beliefs. You think that didn't put an imprint on his daughter? So when she went away to college, she determined she was going to have nothing to do with the benching. When she went in, even though she was an outstanding student and a Polish citizen, she sat on the benches because she wouldn't have any part of that mistreating those people. She ended up coming out of there with a social work degree. She started working in the Warsaw Ghetto during the Nazi oppression. She would go in, and you know one of the reasons they'd let her in? Because they had typhus. And the Germans were not going to go in there, but they let her go in and count quotas and things like that. Well, they didn't know what she was doing. She and 24 other people were going in there, and in Christmas packages, lunch pails, and burlap sacks, they were smuggling out babies. And they smuggled out 2,500 of them. They wrote down all of their names, all of their family names, and they promised those parents, if we live through it, you'll get your babies back. Christian people doing it for Jewish people. They have now today, you can go to the tree where she and her friends buried glass jars full of those names. And after the war, they went back and pulled all those names and tried to reunite the kids with whatever parents were left. Most of them dead. In the 1990s, a little high school out in the Midwest found out about Irina Sendler's story. They researched the story. They put on a play called Life in a Jar that tells the story of this Christian woman saving those babies. Eventually, they started raising money in order to go visit her. They found out she was still alive. A businessman nearby found out that these kids were trying to get enough money to fly to Poland. They asked him how much they had. They had $180. He said, you're going to need some help. So he got some other businessmen together. They raised the rest of the money. They flew over there. They made three trips, in fact. Their play on YouTube got 30 million hits. 30 million. Telling Irina Sendler's story. But they were there when she was still alive. And in this picture, these people right here are all grown-ups of infants she saved. Now, I want you to process something. She couldn't stop Hitler, couldn't stop the war, couldn't stop the invasion. She just decided, well, I will do what I can do to save those that I can save. We need to retrench ourselves in that. We're not going to fix all of Hollywood. We're not going to fix the world's problem. We're not going to fix all of that. And we spend so much time watching television, getting so upset about all the stuff we can't fix, and we are as worried and anxious as our neighbors, and it looks like our Christian faith hasn't done a thing for us. And we need to send a different message, amen? We need to share our faith. And so you've been gracious to be here today. I look forward to seeing you tomorrow afternoon for the third session. God bless you, and thank you for being here this afternoon.